listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. So let's just dive right in. We have quite a full plate as usual.
Yeah, the big news over the weekend was the result of the Colombian election, which went very much according to predictions. And the guy who came out first in the first round of the voting was Iván Duque, who's an extreme right-wing politician, very close to former
Uribe, right?
President Álvaro Uribe, yeah, narco-terror president extraordinaire.
Right.
And Iván Duque got something like, I've forgotten what it was, 33-34% of the vote. And then after him, Gustavo Petro, the former mayor of Bogotá, Colombia's capital, he came second with something like 26, almost 27% of the vote. And then behind him, there was another guy called Sergio Fajardo, who was also a relatively progressive candidate, and he had 25% of the vote. So although I know one can't project those kinds of results, you know, directly, you can't just simply add things up and say, well, that'll be the vote in the second round.
Right.
It does look as though Petro will have the advantage, which is extraordinary, going into the second round, because apart from the vote by Fajardo, there were other votes for kind of centrist and even left-wing parties, and that means that the Petro going into the second round, in theory, could have over 50% of the vote. Which is extraordinary.
That's remarkable. Yeah, that is kind of remarkable. So
now that doesn't mean that Gustavo Petro is kind of a kind of radical progressive by any means. I mean, he's more he's more like somebody like Luis Solis, the former Costa Rican president, or the current president there, Alvarado. They're kind of centrist social democrat types, and it doesn't necessarily mean. Let's assume that Petro wins, just for argument's sake. And if he wins, it's unlikely to make much difference to the situation in between Venezuela and Colombia, because Petro has made very clear that he even refers to Nicolas Maduro as a dictator.
Yeah.
That might just be for electoral purposes, but even if it's not, Petro, when he gets into office, he'll face a National Assembly that's pretty much controlled by the right wing. So he'll have difficulty getting any legislative program through the Colombian legislature. And also he'll be up against the inertia of Colombia's civil servants, both domestically and in their diplomatic service. So it's very unlikely that Colombia's policy towards Venezuela will change. They'll probably remain a member of the Group of Lima, for example, and they'll probably remain extremely susceptible to pressure from the United States government. And let's see, we don't know. But that's if Petro wins. That's the good case. Now, the worst case is if Iván Duque wins. And that means that if Iván Duque wins, there's every chance of some kind of military escalation along the Colombian-Venezuelan border, which probably wouldn't happen under Petro.
Right.
But let's, you know, and so that's looked at in regional terms, that's the situation vis-a-vis Venezuela. And in domestic terms, Iván Duque is, although he says he's not, he is hostile to the peace process and would probably destroy it even more than it is destroyed already. Whereas Petro would probably try and do what he could to rescue it and go some way to meeting the commitments of the Colombian government in that peace agreement that Juan Manuel Santos has studiedly, in a very studied way, avoided implementing, claiming the other powers of state in Colombia are the ones that are holding things up. But if he wanted to push the peace process through and the various provisions that he hasn't honored, his government hasn't honored, he could.
Right.
So then...
let me ask you something about this. Because, I mean, this, you know, we've been watching Colombia for years now, you know, here, you know, doing this segment, and of course the last couple of years with the peace process, we've had the outgoing president, who is a right winger, a soft right winger when compared to Uribe, right. Because he at least wanted to follow this track, compared to Uribe, sort of tempered somewhat the death squad activities, etc. In other words, they tried to broker a peace with, and successfully did, to a degree, a peace with FARC and the other left opposition groups. You come to the election where you have FARC represented also in the election, and you have a hard right candidate and a, I guess you call them a centrist, I guess, Petro. With Human Colombia, I'm wondering if after 60 years of civil war, that we've seen maybe a trend that was first with the current president and now the shaping out of the candidates here, that the people are looking to find like some kind of center so that the polarity that's been represented in the civil war, or the perception of that, is being put to rest. I mean, people have this concept of extreme poles, fighting all the time, and that if you can find a centrist, that this balances. I mean, it's generally an illusion because the terms themselves are pretty elastic if they have any meaning at all. But I'm wondering if the idea that Petro was looked at as a sane, middle of the roader. Is what got him
I think there's a lot of truth to that, and I think that people were misled by last year's referendum, in which there was a no vote against the peace agreement. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
A very narrow vote. Now, that happened at a very difficult time. There was a relatively low turnout of, I think it was just over 40%, the turnout. But that was also due to extraordinary extreme weather conditions at the time, which prevented large numbers of people from even voting.
Right.
Especially in the parts of Colombia where the rainfalls were heaviest.
Yeah, because they're saying yesterday was 53.37% turnout.
That's right, which is very high for Colombia, actually. Or relatively high.
Well, it's higher than 40% for sure.
Yeah. So, and I think that people, observers, may have had a false idea of the strength of the right wing based on what happened last year in that referendum. Because, for example, the Germán Vargas Lleras, who was the vice president, Santos's vice president, he resigned from being vice president to be able to run in the election. He was slated to get over 20%, and he only got 7. And so that gives you an indication of how misleading the referendum result was, and it does indicate that, as you say, there's a strong underswell, if you like, of feeling for a more centrist, more moderate government, especially because now, you see, one of the reasons that Uribe was able to take power in the first place and win re-election was because of the war. But now the war's over.
Right.
I mean, at least as far as the FARC's concerned. And there's still a smaller guerrilla group called the ELN that are currently in peace negotiations with the government of Juan Manuel Santos. But the main war is over. And so people now feel, oh, right, well, we're safe now. We can vote for the center. Because we don't need to vote for the right wing to protect us from the guerrilla.
Right.
And however false that psychology may have been, however untrue it may have been, that was a strong element in the appeal of Álvaro Uribe that made it possible for him to have two terms as president. So then, but let's see what happens. It's June the 17th. There's that's a month away, almost. What, 3 weeks? Something like that.
Yeah.
And so we'll see what happens between now and then. And an interesting comment that I read in an analysis of the result by a team of Colombian analysts is that Duque can't run on fear, which is what Álvaro Uribe used to win his campaigns on, as I was saying earlier.
Right.
But these analysts say that now the ground is open for people like Petro to campaign on positive things like improving the economy, expanding middle class, stuff like that. But one of the interesting things that neither Duque nor Petro mentioned was poverty reduction, and I think that says a lot about the way the electoral context in this kind of South American and Central American Caribbean country that has been dominated by right-wing governments for decades. The context doesn't allow politicians to talk even in moderate reformist terms of poverty reduction. They have to talk in terms of strengthening the middle class. Right?
Yeah.
No, which may be code for the same thing, but
right.
You know? We'll see what happens in Colombia. In Venezuela, following the very important election victory by Nicolas Maduro there, he won, although the turnout was relatively low by Venezuelan standards, 46%. He won with a 67% margin over his nearest rival. And of course, one has to remember that was with an opposition boycott by two or three quite important opposition parties. But he'd have won anyway. and if you look at the numbers. So in the wake of that election victory, Nicolas Maduro is calling for national dialogue. He's trying to reach out to opposition sectors and cut the ground out from under the most extremist sections of the political opposition in Venezuela. And another thing that he's done is there's a guy called Bob Corker, who apparently is a Republican senator in the United States. Yes. With a lot of influence. Is he the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate?
He's on it,
right. So he visited Venezuela either shortly before or shortly after the election, and that led to the liberation of a U.S. citizen called Joshua Holt, who had been detained and imprisoned in 2016,
yeah,
basically on charges of terrorism.
Yeah, he does chair the Foreign Relations Committee, yeah, sorry.
Right, okay. So, yeah, so now analysts in Venezuela are looking at that and saying, well, that's one in the eye for Donald Trump and for Marco Rubio, because what Bob Corker has done is take advantage of his position in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to open up an alternate channel of communication with the Venezuelan government that flies right in the face of the foreign policy of Donald Trump, and of course of the schemes of people like Marco Rubio, Bob Menendez, and the former congressperson, Ileana Rose Letterman. She's not right in Congress anymore, is she? But that's quite important in terms of what is the configuration of the relationship between the Venezuelan government and the U.S. government.
That's an interesting thing, too, by the way, because the foreign policy that Trump has been following towards Venezuela, in fact, at least formally, hasn't changed. Obama was following the same track. He issued executive orders that found that Venezuela was constituted a threat to it was a fundamental threat to the United States, basically, an absurd finding, but a declaration and actions that flowed from that. Obama renewed his own executive order on that point, and then when Trump came in, he also renewed it. Then the interesting thing being that Trump was elected saying, no more regime change, and the track that the U.S. has been on since the election of Hugo Chavez in 1998, really, as evidenced by the coup in 2002 and everything since, is exactly a regime change track.
Yeah, sure. So obviously, Bob Corker is he's no progressive.
There was no break with the White House when Obama was in there, when he was following the same policy. So it's an interesting situation that's developed, and whether it's personal to Trump or not, it's interesting just that where the Senate, Foreign Relations Committee, and the White House were on the same page for the last 9 years, or even for the last 19 years, suddenly the break develops now.
Yeah, so let's see how the important thing from the point of view of the Venezuelan government is that they have an alternate channel of communication to the U.S. Political elite, and they don't.
Right.
That could be important under different possible
right
outcomes. So then, sticking with Venezuela and Colombia, the other very important thing that's happened, of course, is that Juan Manuel Santos has announced that Colombia is going to become a global partner of NATO. That is, in terms of Latin American integration and Latin American policy on peace, on nuclear weapons, and the whole series of issues, that does not bode well for Latin American unity.
Yeah.
Because it renders even more difficult now the ability of the South American nations that want to try and put back together again the Union of South American Nations, which is undergoing a crisis as a result of what may or may not be a definitive withdrawal by member countries of the Lima Group in South America. For example, Chile, Colombia, Peru.
Right.
Argentina. and Brazil too, I think, is part of that group
at the moment. Yeah, I mean, what we're talking about are the, you know, the U.S. puppet states. You've had the entire project that's been ongoing for the last 20 years in Latin America. Well, you know, for on and off for 200, but accelerated with Chavez taking power in 1999. Integration of the various economic activity across the Central America, South America, Caribbean region, mutual support for each other's sovereignty, emphasis on development of the of the region, and further integration of it, accompanied by socialist governments and or left-leaning governments coming to power in a number of countries across the region, and then which they called the Pink Tide at the time, and then the so-called conservative restoration, which consisted of coups d'etat, a couple of election scams, the removal of Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, however you want to characterize that, and that seems to have reached its ebb point also. With the U.S. more or less seeing the limits of its influence come out in Venezuela in the election, and so maybe what we're seeing happen with Corker, for example, is a we've run the limits of that particular policy. Now let's flex it out some.
Yeah, who knows? We'll see how that develops. And it might just be an internal spat in the Republican Party between. Yeah, but anyway, another important thing, and I think you're right about that policy bumping up against its limits. That kind of and I think it's not just in terms of U.S. policy and what the U.S. can get away with, because I think it's also in terms of the limits of neoliberalism. I mean, look at what's happening in Argentina. The Argentina economy is about to collapse. Why? Because Macri promised growth based on private sector investment, and of course that never materialized. So how has he financed government and his government policies over the last 3 years? By debt. Now, for example, over the next couple of weeks or so, Argentina is going to have to pay back $30 billion in debt. Its debt is now more than it was when, I think it's more than it was now, even than when Néstor Kirchner took power. Following the crisis in 2001-2002.
Right, at that crisis, like the horrible crisis it faced. It's worse now.
Yeah, people will say, well, how does that express itself? And it expresses itself in measures like increasing the gas price for ordinary people. Now, remember, Argentina is down in the South Atlantic, and it can get very cold down there. And so people depend on gas not just for cooking, but also for keeping warm. That price increased by 4,000%, right? Mm-mm. Now, you tell me what would happen in the United States if a basic fuel cost increased by 4,000%.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder what the impact was just of that check that Macri delivered to to Obama to hand off to the vulture funds that, nobody in the world thought that they had to pay, and Macri gets elected and writes a check right away.
Yeah, so what you're seeing is the collapse of neoliberal economics. We talked about this right from the day Macri was elected back in November 2015.
That's right. All those roads lead back. Yep.
It's only a question of time before those neoliberal policies collapse the Argentina economy, and then politically, who knows what will happen? And that's where we are now.
Yep. I mean, it's not even a collapse. It's essentially those policies lead to directly where they led last time. If you have a box full of goodies and your policy is to let people loot the box, where it leads to is an empty box at the end of the period. If you refill the box and then change the policy back to letting people loot it, guess what's going to happen?
Yeah. So, and you're seeing the same thing in Brazil. In Brazil right now... Michel Temer, the president who took over after Dilma Rousseff was ousted in that soft coup back in whenever it was, 2016. He's up against a strike by truck drivers, which is quite ironic because back in 1973, it was a strike by truck drivers that started the overthrow process that led to the assassination of Salvador Allende and the military coup in Chile.
Right.
But I mean, there in Brazil, Temer is up against this nationwide truck driver strike again because he increased energy fuel costs. The combination of his policies attacking pensioners, attacking workers' rights, privatizing very extremely valuable state resources and privatizing, selling off the Petrobras's rights to the enormous pre-sal oil deposits that Brazil has discovered over the last few years to foreign companies. All those moves and the effects are gradually adding up, and you can see that if Lula da Silva is finally allowed to run, he'll walk it, because people in Brazil are sick of the measures taken by the authorities under Michel Temer. Now, will Lula be allowed to run? Currently, he's in prison. There are no signs of legal moves that are likely to get him out of prison anytime soon. But his candidacy has been launched by the Workers' Party, his political party, and it remains to be seen whether the Supreme Electoral Tribunal will allow him to be a candidate.
Right.
And I don't see how they can in terms of their ideology, but in terms of pragmatism, they may say, well, if we want Brazil to be governable, we'd better let him run as a candidate. Who knows? I mean, it's just, we'll see over the next couple of weeks.
You know,
if they don't allow him to run, it's not clear at all that the election will lead to a right-wing victory, because there'll be enormous resentment and unrest about the most popular politician in Brazil not being allowed to participate in the election.
Yep. Yeah, while you have all this activity against the current regime, and by the way, the least popular government official probably on the planet. I mean, Temer's been going downhill since he had a 2% favorability rating last year. And
right.
So that's the glue that's being held, holding together this wall against the most popular politician. And by the way, you may remember this, when they had the final vote on Dilma Rousseff back in 2016, they did not vote to bar her from public office for 8 years.
Right.
She's eligible to run again. So if Lula is barred, Dilma Rousseff may end up running, and the way the numbers look at the moment, she may well end up being elected president again.
Yeah, who knows? I don't know enough about Brazil's electoral law, because she can't run for re-election, right?
Right.
But there's been this 2-year
right.
usurper
right.
interim period,
right.
which may allow her to run. Who knows? Let's see what the Brazilian electoral tribunal decides.
Yeah.
Then another big election, of course, that's happening on July the 1st, is the Mexican election.
Yeah, big one. Yep.
And it seems extremely unlikely that, assuming that he isn't assassinated, that Andrés Manuel López Obrador won't win. I mean, he's got well over 40% support, well ahead of the next candidate, who's down on something like 20-something percent. But the thing about that election campaign in Mexico is that, and it, over 100, I think that the total now is 102 candidates, in what is a very complicated election process, because so many different levels of the Mexican authorities are being elected on July the 1st, from municipal candidates up to the president.
Right.
And the campaign for all those elections started something like seven, maybe even 8 months ago. And during that period, 102 candidates at different levels have been murdered. And that's Mexican politics for you.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
And imagine if there were that guy, even anything approaching that level of violence in Venezuela, you'd never hear the end of it. Yeah. But you don't hear anything at all about it in the corporate media.
Yeah.
So, you know, just another example of the double standards that apply in the corporate and alternative media in North America and Western Europe. Speaking about Western Europe, the European Union has decided that they're going to apply more sanctions against Venezuela because they don't accept the election result, as if the European Union knows anything about democracy.
Right.
All these unelected stooges for the elites in the European Commission and the European Central Bank. Yeah. People responsible for the biggest transfer of wealth in history.
Right.
You know,
which is remarkable, considering, you know, this is the repository of the, you know, the history of transferring wealth from the people of the planet to, you know, the elites in Europe.
The home of
imperialism.
And you still get people, even leftists like, I mean, quite well-known leftists like Ignacio Remanet, and I think even Noam Chomsky from time to time, they'll occasionally talk about Western democracies. What a joke. Anyway, on talking about democracy, we should congratulate Mia Mottley of the Barbados Labour Party, because she became the first woman prime minister in the history of Barbados.
Yep.
I think those elections were the weekend before last. And her Barbados Labour Party won all 30 seats in the Parliament there.
Mm.
So congratulations to her. I have no idea what her politics are, but the fact that a strong woman has been elected Prime Minister in Barbados says something, for sure. It says a lot.
And we've got to stop there because we're out of time. There's some other stuff I'd like to have covered that we'll have to cover next week. Or maybe later this week, including what's happening in Ecuador, the air accident in Cuba, Piñera taking office and withdrawing reparations for Pinochet victims in Chile, and a lot more. So, Tony, thank you so much for your time. A pleasure to speak with you, as always.
Okay, thanks a million, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The American political soap opera, widely known as Russiagate, appears to have no end. While no evidence has been revealed that Trump campaign colluded with Russia, there is mounting evidence the intelligence community, or should I say the deep state, monitored or even spied on Trump world. Should there be a special investigation into the misdeeds of the Department of Justice, the FBI, and the CIA? Crosstalking Spygate, I'm joined by my guest, Christopher Niewiem in Washington. He's a Republican strategist. In New York, we have Charles Ortel. He is a private investor and writer, as well as host podcast show Sunday with Charles. And in Los Angeles, we cross to H.A. Goodman. He is a columnist, journalist, published in the Huffington Post, Salon, The Hill, and other publications. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Gentlemen, we're calling this program Spygate, and I have it in quotes, okay, because I'm quoting the President of the United States, and that's what I want to delve into here. H.A., I always go to the person that gets up earliest for the program. That's obviously you in Los Angeles, because I'm exactly on the other side of the world of you right now. We're calling it Spygate, but I was thinking maybe a better title would be The Three Stooges, Brennan, Comey, and Clapper. I think you know where I'm going. Go ahead, H.A.
Well, one question I have to ask is, why is BuzzFeed suing the DNC for evidence to corroborate the Steele dossier? And why did the United States government feel it was necessary to spy or to infiltrate Trump's campaign using Stephen Halper even before the Steele dossier? The next question is, what crime is Trump said to have committed? They've investigated Trump without even accusing him of a specific crime. In Watergate, you had a break-in and a cover-up. You know what happened with Bill Clinton. With Hillary Clinton, she transferred top secret intelligence onto a once unencrypted server. There were crimes and then cover-ups or investigations based on those crimes. With Trump, there's no predicate crime. There's no crime that he's said to have committed. BuzzFeed is suing the DNC very likely because there's no evidence to corroborate the Steele dossier, which was used by James Comey and the FBI to go ahead and get a FISA warrant on Carter Page. They already wiretapped everyone within Trump's campaign. They already caught Trump, President Trump, or then candidate Trump, in incidental communication. They even took one of his servers from Trump Tower.
Right.
They found nothing. There was no evidence of anything. There's no evidence that anyone colluded with Russia.
But
Mueller probe, Trump should fire Mueller tomorrow and simply
you're making the point here. And let me go to Christopher in Washington. Is that the deeper they go into this, the more we see that there is collusion here, but it's collusion within the intelligence community. And H.A., the facts man, that's why I love him having him on the program. The facts are out there. He just gave you a whole list, and I'm sure he could go much further. I mean, why shouldn't there be more focus on that? Because when I watch Brennan and Clapper on cable TV, they're getting more and more hysterical as if it's getting closer and closer to them. Go ahead in Washington, Christopher.
Well, I tend to agree with my colleague in the sense that when you look at all of the things they've been looking at, you get to these tangential things that have nothing to do with the actual investigation, and they're just constantly looking into things and constantly looking into things. I think what we have is, you know, this is like being on a roller coaster and being nauseous and just not being able to get off. I mean, especially for the American voter in terms of, you know, can you trust these politicians? And then can you trust the investigatory apparatus that you're supposed to be able to trust looking into these things? And then you look at investigators that are, you know, have Hillary Clinton posters on their wall and their spouses are donating to campaigns. It really makes you nauseous. So I think at this point, a special counsel should really be brought in for all of these things. I mean, it's like a roller coaster. You can't get off. You're nauseous. So I tend to agree with what my colleague just said before me.
You know, Charles, Jeff Sessions is being criticized a lot for not being more proactive. And we do know that he recused himself. And we have the new FBI director, Ray. I mean, I tend to think, and this is my own personal theory, is that they've realized there was so much collusion against the Trump campaign within the intelligence community that it would really shock the confidence in these agencies. And I think they're really kind of puzzled on how to deal with this, because with every single passing day, we see more and more dots connected, not with Russia and Trump, but how the intel community colluded together to go after this candidate and now as president. I mean, it seems at least patently obvious to me. Go ahead, Charles, in New York.
Yeah, I think the real story here is even more diabolical than we're talking about. I think it goes back to June 2008 when Hillary Clinton conceded to Barack Obama that he would be president and agreed to help. There's a public record of her meeting in Dianne Feinstein's house. And I think ever since then, Team Clinton and Team Obama have been conspiring to weaponize the IRS, the Department of Justice, the CIA, the tech services, etc., to punish enemies of, you know, their branch of the Democratic Party, and to reward friends, whether it be to go after the Tea Party in 2010, to get Barack Obama reelected in 2012, to try to build a position for Hillary Clinton in 2014, and to try to get her elected in 15-16. That's the larger narrative. And in the beginning, I think Donald Trump wasn't in a position to take that narrative on because his base was still, you know, wondering if he'd make it through the perilous honeymoon period where generally you do get a break. And now we're in a place where eyes are opening and we're realizing, you know, what happened from 2009 to 2017 under Barack Obama was a mirage. Low interest rates made it look as if, and big deficit spending made it look as if everything was going well. In reality, we've been party to the grossest abuse of power by an administration ever in the history of this country, going all the way back. And that's the real story. It's not so much 2015-16. And for that reason, we need congressional investigations, joint committees. We need the media to do its job. People like Hal Goodman and others and RT, frankly, who are not part of the mainstream.
Don't hold your breath. Don't hold your breath, okay? I watched Chris Cuomo a couple days ago. I mean, I don't know what is wrong with that guy, but it's delusional. The problem with people like Chris Cuomo, I'm not talking now to H.A., is that they're so invested with this their own conspiracy theory of their own making here that they don't know how, they can't find an exit now. I mean, they just keep doubling down on the most obscure things when there's some really big things right staring us all right in the face here. I mean, they literally liberal media doesn't want to concede it made a mistake because they'll have to make concessions about so many other mistakes they made. Go ahead, H.A. in L.A.
Well, I had the great pleasure of interviewing Charles Lortel numerous times, and he's absolutely brilliant. And he is probably one of the foremost people in terms of knowledge about the Clinton Foundation and Clinton Foundation scandals. And the interesting thing is that Ross Story actually wrote a hit piece on me recently, and they said, oh, my goodness, he's focusing on the uranium sale, H.A. Goodman. And there's a verbatim article title from the New York Times, Cash Flow to Clinton Foundation Amid Russian Uranium Deal. That's the verbatim article title. If you just look at the public record, New York Times, Washington Post, you can see that millions and millions and millions of millions, well, hundreds of millions of dollars flowed into the Clinton Foundation, and then something beneficial took place for the people who gave money to the Clinton Foundation. That is a huge, huge scandal. The reason that Clinton used a private email server,
yeah,
and she eventually transferred top secret and special access program intelligence onto that server, which is, that's the big issue, is how she actually transferred, how she was able to transfer that intelligence from CIPRNet, JWICS, and SCIFs onto her server. The reason she used that server is because of the Clinton Foundation. I think that the Trump-Russia nonsense, mm-hmm. I think the Trump-Russia nonsense is just one way to hide from a giant money laundering scheme called the Clinton Foundation.
What it is, H.A., what it is. Exactly. What it is it's really nothing to see here, folks. Look away. It's a way to absolve the Clinton machine and to place blame on Trump here. I mean, let me go to Christopher in Washington. I mean, I listened to Brennan and Clapper basically saying, you know, surveilling, spying on, whatever word you want to use, on the Trump campaign was actually to protect them and to protect the United States. Why didn't they just tell the campaign, hey, I think we got some worries right here. You might want to be careful who you talk to. I mean, that would have been the right thing to do. It would have been a neutral thing to do if that's in case what it was, because I don't believe it was, because if it was that, they would have done that. Go ahead, Christopher.
I totally agree, Peter. I mean, if you look at the entire investigation of what's happened, there hasn't been any sort of consistency going both sides in terms of just having a standard and sticking to it. And it sort of shocked me throughout the whole soap opera of the Hillary Clinton emails that at some point there's going to be politics and there's going to be all that stuff. But at some point, there has to be some sort of unified standard. If you're breaking the law, you're breaking national security protocol, you should be in trouble. And if you look at, I mean, look at James Comey. I mean, he's a beta male who's on his boring book tour. He's a clown. It's about him. It's not about the duty of the FBI. I think they really need a facelift. I think the brand is really hurting after all this, and just tend to agree with your premise and your lead-in.
Yeah. Charles here, right before we go to the break here, I mean, I'm still going to stick with my narrative, is that I think that like Sessions and Ray and others understand the implications once all of this is revealed about how the deep state colluded against the Trump campaign. It's going to be an institutional crisis when this comes out. Go ahead, Charles.
Look, I think the institution has been in crisis for a long time. You know, Robert Mueller was in charge of the FBI from September 4th, 2001 to September 4th, 2013, then followed by James Comey. Look at the number of disasters that occurred under their respective watches. They couldn't find obvious Clinton Foundation fraud. They missed the Uranium One scandal. They missed the Laureate scandal. They missed the scandal reorganizing the Clinton Foundation 2009 forward. You know, what didn't they miss? And the reality is that technological tools have gotten ever stronger. And we the American public, the wider world, needs a debate about how much power security services should have, particularly in our country, to snoop inside our country and then not to take care of that those secrets aren't disseminated around to blackmail politicians, to blackmail donors, and you know, to be used for nefarious purposes. I think we need to have eyes wide open here, a major league investigation, and anyone, no matter how powerful, who broke these laws needs to be investigated, ideally indicted, convicted, and sent away to prison.
Okay, well, you know, right before we do the break here, Mueller did find those 17 Russian trolls in St. Petersburg. You know, don't underestimate him. Gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Donald Trump's Spygate.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let's go back to Los Angeles. H.A., Charles made a wonderful point at the end of the first half of the program here. Is this what they're really afraid of with a second investigation? Because, first of all, the first one with Mueller is not... Look, Christopher, you're in Washington, D.C. I mean, if something really important about collusion with Trump and Russia, it would have been released a long, long, long time ago. I mean, how many leaks? And there are always leaks one direction. Have you noticed that? Anyway, let me stay with H.A. here. I mean, they're afraid of the second investigation because it really will reveal institutional corruption. And I even think, and this is where I think it gets really tricky and dicey, because that goes beyond party affiliation. And I think that's why they're very hesitant about this, because it will ensnarl a lot more people, not just one side. Go ahead, H.A.
Well, let's look at who has been investigating Donald Trump. John Brennan lied under oath about spying on the Senate. James Clapper lied under oath about the NSA spying on Americans. James Comey lied under oath about exonerating Clinton before her interview. Peter Strzok, in a text message, said, "We can't take the risk." He used the word risk. "We can't take the risk of Trump becoming president. We have to engage in an insurance policy that we spoke about in Andrew McCabe's office." Trump should just fire Mueller and tweet that text. But then let's look at Andrew McCabe. He lied under oath twice and lied four times. This is the Office of Professional Responsibility at the FBI. So you have all of these people who were in immense positions of power lying, either lying under oath or obviously part of not a conspiracy theory, an actual conspiracy of individuals to achieve a political goal. John Brennan met with Harry Reid during the election to inform Harry Reid of alleged Russian interference. Why didn't he inform President Obama? Why didn't he meet President Obama? The NSA, the FBI, and the CIA have a $35 billion combined budget. For $35 billion, the American people get moderate to high confidence. And if you look at the ODNI and DHS reports, the two intelligence reports that all of this is based on, there's nothing certain, there's zero evidence, and there are warranty disclaimers stating that even high confidence, the highest level of assessment, even high confidence could be wrong.
Yep.
And they actually say in one of the reports, don't take anything we say as fact. So the intelligence reports are completely just basically opinion, $35 billion of opinion. You have the DNC, who never gave its computer servers to the FBI. They hired CrowdStrike through Hillary Clinton purchasing through her law firm, CrowdStrike, paying CrowdStrike and also paying Christopher Steele and Fusion GPS and Glenn Simpson for the Steele dossier. If anyone colluded with Russia, yeah, it was Hillary Clinton,
well,
who purchased the Steele dossier,
right, and it was
compiled with Russian sources.
And the foreign country is the UK, not Russia here. Christopher, I mean, in watching the cable stations, is it conceivable in your mind that President Obama knew nothing about what his underlings were doing? Is that conceivable in your mind?
It could be. I mean, I think there was a general awareness. I mean, certainly. And he had to know sort of the obsessive instincts of Hillary Clinton wanting to be president. I mean, you know, we've heard the anecdotes from election night in terms of the people that Hillary Clinton was most angry at was Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and then Donald Trump. It was everyone's fault but her own. But we should definitely take a pause for a second to acknowledge Hillary Clinton's talent. She can't even cheat and win. You know, I mean, you'd think that if you're cheating and you have all this behind you, you'd win. She can't even cheat and win. And the whole thing about, you know, 3 million votes, she won L.A. and she won New York.
Right.
Great job. You got all those electoral votes. Hillary Clinton couldn't even cheat and win.
Yep. Charles, I want to go. I'm not going to let Obama off the hook here, because it's been explained to me by a number of people that have experience in high government is that such a coordinated plan, such as we're discussing right now, could not have been done without the White House knowing about it. So what did he know and when did he know it, Charles?
I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, I think that in this narrow matter, The Clintons and the Obamas got together, I believe, in the June through November 2008 timeframe. They hammered out a deal. The memorandum of understanding that supposedly regularized relations between the Clinton Foundation or among the Clinton Foundation, Bill Clinton, and the Secretary of State is a complete piece of garbage. It's not enforceable. That wouldn't have gotten across the line if there were real lawyers. Remember Barack Obama, president of the Harvard Law Review, Hillary Clinton, smartest lawyer in the world. You know, from the very beginning, this was an artifice. The Clintons had something on Obama. We don't yet know what it was. And Obama decided to play along. He was in for two terms. Hillary was supposed to succeed him and then cover all the stuff up. And so absolutely, I believe, certainly Valerie Jarrett, his consigliere, or consigliera, I guess, she knew all about this. And, you know, it's high time that we go back over this, because the thing to remember, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, this is a horrible precedent that people are going to look back for decades and say, you can get away with this type of criminal behavior 20 years from now, 40 years from now, maybe 4 years from now or 2 years from now. Somebody's going to try to do far worse than the Clintons and the Obamas did. And we need to expose what happened. We need to investigate, indict, convict, and incarcerate people who did this and send them away for a long, long time and take away all of their stuff.
You know, H.A., I think a lot of viewers watching this program initially think that we're very partisan here. And I think Charles put it in the best possible words. I mean, I'm not doing this. I mean, everybody knows my partisan politics, but it's not being played out on this program. I think what all of us are talking about is institutions and values and the rule of law. And I think that's what really ties us all together. I'm a conservative. H.A., I know you're a progressive here, but we're on the same page about a decency in public life and officials being held accountable. And this is why I think we need another investigation to make sure that government officials, especially particularly the unelected ones, are held to account. Go ahead, H.A.
Well, absolutely. And there's a famous CNN clip of President Obama saying it's absolutely impossible that candidate Trump should stop whining.
Yeah.
And it's impossible that anyone could rig the election. And he went on and on about how the experts and all the authorities and the most educated people would never, ever stoop so low as to blame anyone for an election loss. So Trump should just stop whining. Then we have nonstop whining, continual, never-ending whining from Clinton and the Democratic Party. They're going to lose in the midterms. They had like what a 13 or 14 point lead in the generic polls for both the House and the Senate. They'll lose the Senate, or the GOP will keep control of the Senate and keep control of the House, and they're going to limp into 2020. Trump, unless there's something, God forbid, that's just unforeseen, Trump will easily defeat Democrats in 2020. Because Democrats don't stand for anything. They think that people care about Russian interference in the election.
They
Nobody
don't.
Cares.
Nobody cares.
Polls are showing that people are tired of Mueller. Mueller doesn't stand for anything. If he could indict people on jaywalking, he would. There's no collusion with Russia. There's no evidence of anything. The interesting aspect of all of this is that Democrats have convinced themselves that, for example, the Trump Jr. meeting is some kind of example of treason. Trump Jr. never got any emails from Clinton, and even if he did, they would have emanated from a server that was once unencrypted outside the U.S. government that stored special access program intelligence. And by the way, Anthony Weiner had 18 classified emails on his laptop, and we don't even have to get into the pictures on that laptop. So the issue here is the biggest cybersecurity scandal in history. You had a Secretary of State in Hillary Clinton who had special access program intelligence that was transferred somehow onto her server. Maybe Brian Pagliano, maybe Justin Cooper. Nobody knows right now, but the DOJ is actually investigating
how the information was transferred. But H.A., but a lot of people around the world know exactly what was on that server. It was like an open barn door.
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody
Absolutely.
Stopped by, okay? And that's why I don't think any kind of foreign intelligence service would have ever said anything about about it. I mean, if you're going to keep getting this free information from the Secretary of State, why do you want to interrupt it? Let it keep coming. No one in their right mind would have said, Julian Assange, we have the emails. Nobody in the intelligence community would ever do anything like that. It was a gift that just kept on giving. Okay, Christopher, let me go to you because, you know, the Mueller investigation here, I mean, what does he have to show to prove that his worth over all this long time period here? I mean, Paul Manafort had nothing to do with Russia. Papadopoulos had nothing to do with Russia. I mean, he lied to the FBI. None of these things had. Oh, no, 17 kids. OK, they can't even speak English. And most of the ads on Facebook were after the election. I mean, I don't understand how MSNBC and CNN keep this going. I mean, most of it's just silly. Okay, go ahead, Christopher.
No, I think that the point was made earlier about sort of like you're dedicated to this track and you just don't know when to stop. I mean, you've hit the brick wall and your foot is still on the gas. I think they've committed themselves to that narrative for so long, they wouldn't know what to do with themselves if they tried to do something else. And in terms of Hillary Clinton's excuse, I mean, she wrote a whole book about it. I mean, it's like, what happened? It's the only book where the question and the answer is on the cover. You know, Hillary Clinton happened.
That's right.
So I thought that's, I mean, that's kind of the way I look at it. But in terms of Mueller, I think that I think it's problematic, and I think that there's just been a lot of lost faith. I mean, now they're sort of harassing essentially Trump's friends. I mean, some of his advisors, they've looked into, they're harassing their businesses, their associates. I mean, again, it's almost like the same issue we touched on with CNN. You're so committed to that, you don't know where to turn back. But I think they need to have independent counsels look at all this stuff from now on so the people can at least have some faith. Wherever the compass falls, it'll be fair and regardless of political outcome.
Okay, we're almost out of time. I want to ask Christopher a real quick question. I think Carter Page is going to get a big check one day from the U.S. government for defamation. Yes or no? What do you agree? Agree or not?
It's possible. You know, I mean,
what do you think, Charles?
The defamation let me laws ask in Charles, this country should.
What do you think, Charles? Think Carter Page is going to have a payday?
The check is going to be denominated bigly.
Okay.
As Trump would say.
Bigly. Okay. Big. All right, gentlemen. That's all the time we have here. Many thanks to my guests in Washington and in New York and in Los Angeles. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.